Well, on today's edition of the Groundings podcast, I have a very special guest that makes the title of the podcast even more relevant to the discussion. I have with me Asha Rodney, the youngest child of Walter Rodney, who the name and legacy of this podcast is dedicated to. So Asha, thank you for being here with me.
Thank you for inviting me.
Definitely. So Asha is the co-chair of the Walter Rodney Foundation here in Atlanta. She practices law in Atlanta as well and is an activist and educator. And that's a very humble description of all she does. So I have Asha today, and what we wanted to discuss was a bit about Walter Rodney's legacy, but more specifically about his assassination and then the commission of inquiry, which has been going on for how long now?
It started in 2014.
In 2014.
And terminated in 2016. So we'll kind of orient everyone about what's happening with the commission of inquiry.
Definitely. So we'll be covering kind of what the family and the organizers and activists around the family have done to seek justice for his assassination, essentially. So before we get started and actually talking about all that, can you tell me a little bit about who your father was?
Walter Rodney was a son of the soil of Guyana, a former British colony, Guyana. And he is best known for his works, How Europe Underdeveloped Africa, his thesis, A History of the Upper Guinea Coast, The Groundings with My Brothers. So he is by training, he is a historian, expert in African history, and a scholar activist. So when we really think about Walter Rodney, we think about his scholar activism and what his works and his life represented for people in the Caribbean, people in Africa, and just people in the diaspora in general.
And I want to just note real quick, you mentioned him as a historian. Some of his lesser known works are actually like histories. I love his History of Guyana, for example. So, you know, that's just an interesting fact that a lot of people kind of glaze over and just pay attention to How Europe and Groundings, but he actually is a really good historian, too.
Right. His work on Guyana was called The History of the Guyanese Working People, and it covered, the labor movements and the history, the tradition of slaves and indentured people into Guyana. So it's a very interesting historical document.
And he was actually one of the first to do, like, a people's history, you know, from the perspective of the people and the working class. And even if you notice the perspective of history he gives and How Europe, it's from, you know, the people's perspective. So that's very important.
And in writing about people, he wrote from the perspective of where we all came from. So Guyana in particular is a country that is filled with people of different races. So you have people of African descent, people of Indian descent, people of Amerindian or indigenous descent. So he talked about all those different cultures, and he wanted us to understand what those cultures were, understand our differences, and then be able to be cohesive as a civil society. And some of his lesser known works, people don't know that he also wrote children's books. He had started writing a line of children's books specifically about that, our history, like Kofi Badu Out of Africa. So he's trying to teach people about their culture, about their history, so we can have a better understanding of ourselves.
And it's amazing. Recently, someone asked me to give them some excerpts from How Europe to use in a class, and I gave them the part about colonial education. So when you think about him writing about colonial education, and then he actually started writing children's books, almost as if he was trying to combat, you know, that system of colonial education that existed. Okay, well, cool. So I guess in order to talk about the Commission of Inquiry and his assassination, we kind of need to know what was happening in Guyana and what he was doing and involved in Guyana, Walter Rodney. So can you give us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so So in the 70s, let me take it back to 68, around the time of 68, when Walter Rodney would have left Jamaica, and then he went back to Tanzania to teach. After that point, he returned to Guyana to take up a teaching position at the University of Guyana in 71, I was born in 71, 73, I'm sorry. And the government rescinded his appointment. So he arrives in Guyana. He doesn't have a job at the university as intended. My mother, Dr. Patricia Rodney, it's hard for her to work because they don't they're trying to take away her employment as well. So he is back in Guyana, and he is working against the corruption of the Guyanese government at the time.
Mm-hmm.
The government, it was called the PNC, and the government used race as a way to divide the people.
Mm-hmm.
And what Walter Rodney stood for was, we are the working people. We all have similar goals, similar struggles. And he was the, you know, his method was to teach people about their history, teach us about our differences and our similarities, and allow us to then be cohesive.
Mm-hmm.
And he was seen as a threat to the government because of that. Because before, politics in Guyana was won on numbers. You either voted black or Afro-Guyanese, or you voted Indo-Guyanese for the most part. So this was a new platform where it didn't matter what race people were, it didn't matter where they came from. You have masses and throngs of people who are about to stand up against this
mm-hmm.
authoritarian government. So mm-hmm. that was why they felt challenged by Rodney.
I see. And so it's almost as if what made Rodney dangerous was his... Because a lot of people during the time would say, like in Jamaica, where we had the same kind of Indo-Jamaican, Afro-Jamaican, mm-hmm. would say we need to connect the working class and racists combined. But he was actually kind of working towards it, like, materially. And the people, he had an influence on the people to where they were actually kind of joining forces and beginning to have this coalition party, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Right. So the WPA was the Working People's Alliance. And it was a coalition party, a people's party, and But I think what was organic and what was different about Guyana at the time is that people were hungry for change and people were receptive to something different, something more powerful.
Mm.
And they realized that this kind of class and race politics was not what would move Guyana forward.
Mm-hmm.
And so just the sheer numbers of people that were standing up to this regime that had never done that before was something that was just different to Guyana at the time and really to the region.
And would you say that his traveling, because, I mean, he was well-traveled, you know, you'd literally know,
mm-hmm.
Jamaica, across the continent, Russia, Cuba. Would you say that he was almost taking from what he saw and learned in other places, whether it was socialist countries or, you know, other political leaders, and making it like specific to the Guyanese people?
I don't know if I can make that leap. What I can say is that he was a growing individual. So he grew through his academics. You know, he went to the University of the West Indies, Mona, then he went to SOAS and did his studies. And then from there he was lecturing, like you said, in Tanzania and different mm-hmm. places in the world, in the U.S. as well. And I think he took those lessons, you know, working with the freedom fighters on the continent, he
mm-hmm.
took those lessons, certainly, and took them back with him to Guyana because he wanted to make a difference there. He felt as if he had been doing all this work in different places, but he wanted to give back to his country and to make a difference, particularly because in the Caribbean, at least in the British system, we are given our education. You know, it's free. Our education is free. So he felt like he owed the Guyanese people his service for what he had accomplished. So that was one of the reasons why he wanted to go back to Guyana. And then he felt like he could actually make a difference on the ground at that time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And, okay, cool. So can you briefly describe... I know you mentioned the kind of racial tension inside of Guyana. And you mentioned the political party in power being authoritarian and kind of a harsh regime. Can you give me a little bit more details about the party in power, or, you know, just, I guess, the context, you know what I mean?
Well, the overarching reason for some of the work that was happening at the time, in addition to just, you know, the authoritarianism, the, you know, only political lackeys being able to get certain things in the country, whether it's food or jobs, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
One of the underlying things that was happening again at the time was that they were trying to change the constitution.
Mm-hmm.
And to allow a president that would be able to override and veto any other system. And that was one of the core things that Rodney was fighting against, too. So it was, yes, you're dealing with race, you're dealing with class, you're dealing with all these other things, labor, but he's dealing with something that's really fundamental to the country itself, the Constitution. And just for the audience to know, 3 or 4 months after he was assassinated, that Constitution was put in place. And that Constitution is still alive today.
Wow.
Okay, so that's one of the core struggles that he was fighting against as well. So the PNC was the party. Burnham was the party in power. And the state controlled everything, went through the police, through the army. You couldn't get jobs. They would surveil them, harass them. People were tortured, beaten, disappeared during that time period. But it was all done under the power of the state. And if you weren't a friend of the party, particularly as a black person, you were ostracized.
And it was this pattern we've seen many times where the leader uses this faux revolutionary or faux radical kind of rhetoric and public messaging and language, normally supported by the West, right, to do these terrible things. So it creates this kind of conflict of, well, they're saying they're a Pan-Africanist or using the Pan-Africanist label, or saying they're a revolutionary radical while acting completely different.
Right. And I think in this case, that really happened with the Burnham regime, particularly with his stance on apartheid in South Africa and standing up for black people everywhere. But at the same time, while he had this public persona, internally, it's the opposite, right? So you do have this dynamic of a public profile versus what's actually happening in country.
Yeah, definitely. And we see that a lot today. It's just, I just had to mention that because it's extremely relevant when you look around the world today as well. I'm interested. I think you've definitely kind of set the stage for the work that Walter Rodney was interested in doing and implementing what he was trying to change in Guyana. So I guess I want to know the specifics, if you're okay with sharing them, of his assassination, the days leading up to it, the actual events, and why it's important.
Well, Walter Rodney was assassinated on June 13th, 1980. And we consider that Black Friday. So on Black Friday in 1980. And the events leading up to it were just the usual political meetings, the political organization around
the work.
I mean, yes, surveillance, as we all know now, had been stepped up. My father actually had, I won't say premonitions, but he knew that he was in a difficult place, in a dangerous place. And he had expressed to my mother that he was seriously considering leaving Guyana and going abroad, possibly to Zimbabwe, where he had an invitation to write a history of that country. He was seriously thinking about leaving at that moment. He had felt as if things in Guyana were getting heated to a point where they hadn't been before, and that was, I believe, his mindset. But for him, he was continuing his struggle. He wasn't packing up to leave right away, but he was certainly saying, look, I think that we need to do something different for our family. I think we need to go somewhere else.
So he could feel a shift in his, not only his safety, but the safety of your entire family.
Right. And he had done some other things, going into the embassy, just asking questions about our protection and what would happen, things like that. So in retrospect, I know that it was on his mind. At the time, we couldn't tell as children, what was actually happening with him internally. But Walter Rodney was continuing his struggle. And at the time of his assassination, he was trying to find a way for the members of the party to communicate with each other. So what would happen is if we had a public meeting, or even if you didn't, people would disappear. You couldn't hear from them. There were police raids on homes and on public gatherings. So people would be scattering and running through bushes, and some of them would be detained for days at a time. Nobody knew where people were, and it was a very dangerous situation. So he was taking a lesson from the continent where freedom fighters would use walkie-talkies, and he was trying to create that same system in Guyana. Well, it was banned. Walkie-talkies were banned, obviously, because any kind of, public communication was banned. It had to be through the state.
I see.
So he was working on a walkie-talkie system that could be used.
I see.
So the government, and a bomb was placed in a walkie-talkie,
mm-hmm.
and it was detonated, and it blew up in a car. Walter Rodney and his brother Donald Rodney were in the car at the time. They were testing the device, and the person who created the device had placed a bomb in it on behalf of the state, and it blew up and killed my father. It injured my uncle Donald Rodney, but mm-hmm. he survived. But my father was killed on the scene.
So, you know, one of the things, I recently read a piece by C.L.R. James, mm-hmm. who said, and I don't agree with the piece, mm-hmm. I'm just, you know, he said Walter Rodney should have known the bomb was there, which to me, given the context of what was occurring and the necessity of needing some kind of alternative communication, right? I think caution is obvious, but I think that knowing that in something as simple as a walkie-talkie, that the state would use that as a mechanism for your destruction, it's one, vile, but two, it's almost hard to predict. You know what I'm saying? At a time like that.
Absolutely. I mean, there have been, you know, criticisms about Rodney going back to Guyana. There have been criticisms about his naivete, about what the government was capable of. But I don't think, even looking back now, that we really understood the level of the conspiracy and the planning to take his life.
Mm.
And through the Commission of Inquiry, we were able to establish that. But this was not just I'm placing a bomb and he didn't know. This was a plan that had been in place, and it was on all levels of government.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah, and I've heard your mother speak about it before, Patricia mm-hmm. Rodney, and, you know, she says that there were even ways that the government kind of messed up in reporting the accident and the incident that alerted them that there was some kind of internal plan, if I'm not mistaken.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So I would say hindsight is always 20/20. If I could go back and change time, if you could go back mm-hmm. and change time, people say, of course you should have known. But in that moment, when his focus was, how do I continue to do this work? How do we continue to communicate? How do we continue to strategize and to be able to bring this government down? In his mind, I think that was what was his priority.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe his safety, even though it was in the back of his mind, it wasn't in the forefront of his mind. And even if it was, with a government that was so determined to assassinate him, it may not have happened that day,
mm-hmm.
but it probably would have happened anyway.
And it would have escalated.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So Walter Rodney was killed in 1980. And from then on, the family had been calling for justice, not just into his assassination, but into the subsequent conviction of my uncle Donald Rodney as a part of this conspiracy. Because the government's position was that Walter Rodney was trying to create a bomb to blow up the prison, right? So that was their reason for having the test close to the prison, or wanting to have the test close to the prison walls. Instead, it didn't happen close to the prison walls because, you know, between Donald and Rodney, they did not follow that route they intended him to take. So their theory that he was trying to blow up the prison didn't hold much water, but that was the theory government.
Do they say that he was trying to blow up the prison in the sense of freeing the people inside of it, or just randomly blow up? I mean, that doesn't even make sense.
And it doesn't make sense in multiple ways in terms of the layer of the evidence, but that was what they wanted the society to believe, mm-hmm. so that it was okay, right? Rodney was a victim of his own bad deeds.
Yeah.
So he's not a hero. Mm-hmm. You know, he's trying to blow this prison up, as opposed to, yeah.
And at the time of the assassination, you know, which was in the middle of Rodney's organizing and activism,
mm-hmm.
do you know what the response from the Guyanese people was like? I'm curious.
Yeah, absolutely. There was just outrage, fear. I think the primal response was fear.
Mm-hmm.
Because even though there had been some other stuff that happened before, people, you know, people were beaten all the time and disappeared. But this, other than, there are two or three other incidents that people need to know about. There was the killing of Father Dark. There was the killing of Ohini Kawama. Mm. So there were some other things that happened at the time. But for Rodney to be assassinated, there was a It was a chilling effect.
Because he was not only kind of the center of everything, but he was also this international icon.
Right, like a popular, people would say a popular hero, a popular person.
I see.
Advocate for the people. And so I think it created this chilling in the society of fear. People were scared even before Rodney was killed to go out to political meetings. So even though your job was threatened, you could get fired, you could get demoted, and you would lose your privilege in society, people would still go out to these meetings, but they would hide, they would walk, things like that.
Sure.
When Rodney was assassinated, I believe there were almost 30,000 people that came out to his funeral and procession through Guyana.
Wow.
And that would be people, you know, local people, Guyanese, people from the Caribbean, people from all around the world went into Guyana.
Mm.
So I would say the world felt, the country definitely felt the loss. But I think it was also something more like, okay, we don't know what else to do now because this is not what we would expect to happen.
I see. So the explosive device inside of the walkie-talkie, which was given by a state actor, goes off. They claim Walter Rodney and Donald Rodney were attempting to blow up the prison.
Mm-hmm.
What next?
So what followed next was a series of propaganda. There were flyers that were littering the streets. You know, there was a nursery rhyme, Hickory Dickory Dock, and that he died with a blast, a bomb at 8 o'clock. Okay, so they said, so he was essentially he created his own death at 8 o'clock that night. So these flyers were on the street within moments of his assassination, so they would have had to be preprinted.
As if they
right?
were already printed,
already
and,
printed
prepared.
And prepared. Okay,
wow.
You had announcements on the state media that an unidentified man had been killed near the prison. So there were all these different things coming out from the state apparatus they would not have had the ability to know as yet
mm-hmm.
what had actually transpired unless they had foresight and foreplanning.
Mm-hmm. And I believe, wasn't it that they said, and that the state media said it was an unidentified man because they expected him to be unidentifiable, but he was actually
identifiable,
very identifiable.
And he was supposed to be unidentifiable because a part of the instructions that they had for the walkie-talkie to test it was for him to hold it up to his face. Like, you had to be looking at it. You know, this is like basic stuff, not
right,
the technology
right,
we have today. So it should have been at his face. He should be talking into the walkie-talkie. So they expected clearly that his face would be blown off.
I see.
So that's why it was talked about unidentified.
So they had all the media prepped and ready to go, essentially.
Right.
Wow.
Whereas, because it was in his lap
mm-hmm.
and it actually detonated his body,
I see.
His face was untouched.
Mm.
And that was one of the clear things that, in terms of evidence, that shows that it was this state planning.
Conspiracy.
And conspiracy. One of the
or
things.
I guess conspiring, I should
conspiring.
Say. It's not really a conspiracy
mm-hmm.
anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It's more so evidence of conspiring.
Mm-hmm.
So moving forward from that, the family,
mm-hmm.
And your mother has done many years of
mm-hmm.
great work,
mm-hmm.
Has made sure to keep the assassination in mainstream discourse
mm-hmm.
among the Caribbean and Pan-African communities.
Mm-hmm.
So what has some of that work been, you know, to lead up to the actual State Commission of Inquiry?
So following Walter Rodney's assassination, the family reached out for justice in so many different ways, you know, with friends in the community, with community organizations, really the world. You know, it was just, we need justice for Walter Rodney. And one of the first things that was done was the inquest, and we can talk a little bit about that. But in Guyana, there's a formal inquest that happens after a death
mm-hmm.
in Walter Rodney, and it usually happens within 2 months of a death. In Walter Rodney's case, it took 8 years.
Wow.
So even just to get an inquest, which was then totally flawed in terms of what evidence they allowed, in terms of false statements that were given at the inquest itself. So that's a formal proceeding that was held, and that's one of the things even today we're challenging, is the outcome of the inquest itself.
And you say it took 8 years?
Yes, just for the inquest to happen. The ICJ, which is the International Commission of Jurists, they went in, they did a report, which was one of the reports that was reviewed by this commission of inquiry that was formed in 2014. My brother did a fast, I believe in 93, you know, where he sat outside the government offices and demanded justice for his father. So there have been numerous calls for justice in the context of Donald Rodney, who was convicted as in plotting this with Walter Rodney. His appeals for justice have been ongoing because he stands convicted right now still. So he is still working for justice on that platform. So it's ongoing.
Right,
an ongoing struggle for justice right now.
And that actually leads into what my next question was going to be, is I want the listeners to understand the implementations of, you know, what the outcomes of the inquiry could be, right, if accepted and shared publicly. Like you said, Donald Rodney, Walter's brother, stands convicted for his murder. They pinned it on him. And then, if I'm not mistaken, your family has never received any form of compensation from the state or reconciliation, you know, type of funds or anything. The other people who were murdered and assassinated during this period as well have pretty much, these are entire groups of activists and organizers whose, them and their family are still either convicted or without any kind of repatriation.
So the Commission of Inquiry lasted for 2 years. It started in 2014 and it ended in 2016 with a formal report. And that report is actually available for the audience to read. It's on the Atlanta University Center, Robert W. Woodruff Library. If you just Google Walter Rodney Commission of Inquiry Report, it's actually there for you to read yourself, to read all the details about what actually happened again at that time. The report itself has been acknowledged by the Guyana government in that they've received it, but it has not been accepted by the government. So it sits as an unaccepted document in the office of the president. And more recently, and of course the government has said that the report is flawed, the report is false, because we're circled back around to today when the same government that assassinated my father is back in power.
And they were recently elected.
Yeah, they were elected at the time that the Commission of Inquiry was ongoing. They shunted the Commission of Inquiry, they shut it down, and required the commissions to submit the report as is without completing the additional witnesses and additional evidence. There were at least over 100 people that wanted to give testimony, and there were several people that were not able to do so because the Commission of Inquiry ended. So this government shut it down, has not accepted the report, and as of today, I believe maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago, have said they don't even know what the report says, they don't know what the findings are, and they haven't published it to the Guyanese public. So there's a system in place for, if it's acknowledged and accepted, to be produced as an official government report. That has not been done. So people who are reading the report are reading the report that has been disseminated, but is not a formal document that the government itself has circulated.
I see. And just to give listeners an understanding, because I know the term Commission of Inquiry can seem kind of foreign, or it's like a very legal term to some people. Can you just on a basic level explain what a Commission of Inquiry is and what it entails?
Okay, so the Commission of Inquiry that was set up for Walter Rodney's assassination was set up through the Office of the President in Guyana under one of their constitutional statutes. And the commission was set up to investigate certain terms or references, and the basic one would be why was Walter Rodney killed, who killed him, and why and how. Okay. And it was, the commission was three well-known jurists, what they call Queen's Counsels in the Caribbean. So three well-known jurists. They had a commission team itself, which had lawyers, admin staff, their transcripts of all the proceedings. This was a formal court hearing, essentially. Public hearing. Public hearings were held, you know, on a particular schedule, on a public schedule. So it's a full-blown inquiry where people are coming in, they're
like
giving testimony, they're submitting written statements, they're under cross-examination so, of course, if I'm giving evidence, which I did, my mother did, then she could be cross-examined by any of the other parties. So she could have been cross-examined by PNC attorneys, labor attorneys, whoever was a standing party could cross-examine witnesses. So it was an open, adversarial legal proceedings, essentially. That's what a commission of inquiry was.
And you said it lasted for 2 years.
It lasted for a period of 2 years with scheduled hearings over a period of time.
And, I mean, for people who were present, like you said, your mother and you know, gave evidence and testified, I think you said as well. That can also be like an emotional process, right? Because not only are you're kind of reliving what you educate about all the time, but you're doing it in front of the actual government, who you and your hearts and minds and through evidence are certain that was responsible for what you're actually testifying about, right?
Yeah, it's terribly emotional for my mother, I think for all the witnesses that came forward. There was certainly an element of emotion, of release. People hadn't been able to speak about these things publicly. They may have spoken about them privately. But then to be on a platform where it's open to the public, it's live online, it's streaming live, where, you know, the world is watching you, and you have to kind of relive and talk about what actually happened in those days. And some of the people who actually committed those acts are there in the room with you sometimes. Right. So it was very, very difficult. I think it was cathartic for some people. This was the first time my Uncle Donald had testified publicly at all. So for him, it was an overwhelming experience. I mean, if you think about being in a car when a bomb detonates and your brother dies next to you, and you're living with that every day of your life, and you have shrapnel in your skin, it was just a very emotional experience for him. But it also was so enlightening, even for us who knew some of the details. Just listening to the testimony, your jaw would just drop every day, because the level of the corruption, the level of the actors and their actions is really amazing. And I hope the audience gets a chance to read the report, because as this current government continues to throw the report on the pile and say, hey, we're not doing anything on Walter Rodney, we don't care about this report, it is history and we're done with it. It's not history, and we're not done with it. Mm-hmm. And the lessons that are coming out of what happened in Guyana are critical, not just to Guyana, but for us everywhere, right? For activists everywhere.
Definitely. And I think it speaks to, this could be a fault on us as activists who might not be figuring out how to do it best, but just to the world as in general, that I think this is a moment that the whole entire world, right? Like Walter Rodney educated so many people around the world. And while many, many people are paying attention, this should, among the left, like among us who are revolutionaries and radicals and organizers and activists, this commission of inquiry, while it took place, should have been headline news and all that was talked about. So the level of counter-propaganda and undermining of the commission of inquiry that took place on the Guyanese government's part had to have been very strong, as you already noted and said, for there not to be some huge, like, world reaction to this on a scale that I think it should have been.
Right. And I think, too, it's multiple levels and layers. So you have to look at Ghana in its own context. You have to look at Ghana in its regional context as being a part of the Caribbean, where even the Caribbean leaders have not come out. And that can be for a variety of reasons. You know, people try to be insular or to look after what's happening in their own countries. Sometimes it's, now we have a black party in power, so, we're supporting, the black government. So there are all these different reasons for people to not say anything, to feel like they don't have to take a stance, which is counter to what we know we have to do,
right?
Particularly because that's what Rodney did. He stood up for all of us.
Definitely.
And I think that when we as activists fail to investigate and to interrogate these facts, we fail ourselves, because we're the only ones that can do the work. They're not going to do the work for us. So we're going to need to sit down and really interrogate those facts. And in Guyana, in particular, this conspiracy was massive. From the prime minister, the police chief, the GDF, which is the army, the passport office to get passports, birth certificates, first flights out, you had to get air civil control. I mean, there's all these different things that are happening on a massive scale. And that's pre-conspiracy, much as the post-conspiracy follow-up with getting Smith out of the country and into Cayenne. And I mean, it's massive.
Well, and I don't think we've actually in this interview even mentioned Smith at all. Mm-hmm. I mean, mentioned but not named. Mm-hmm. And those are some of the most damning details to come out of mm-hmm. the Commission of Inquiry. So can you tell a little bit about who he was and his role?
Well, Smith, Gregory Smith, was a... was in the GDF, and he was a radio kind of technical expert, and he was the one that was working on the walkie-talkie for Rodney, or for them. And at the after Rodney was assassinated, the government said they didn't know who Gregory Smith was. They didn't know who he was. They didn't know he was a part of the army. They totally disclaimed him.
Wow.
And then reports started to come out about, no, he's an officer in the GDF. No, he was seen on an aircraft being taken from, you know, Georgetown to where he lives and then out of the country. So all these media reports started swirling around, and they finally had to admit, okay, he was a part of our ranks. Okay, so a lot of the information was hidden by the government, but a lot of it came out during the mm-hmm. inquiry.
And he was the one who gave, you said, the walkie-talkie to Walker.
He's the one that built it and gave it to them, right? So all the records came out during the Commission of Inquiry, you know, that he, where he was, where he operated from, the orders that he was given, the date that he was supposed to give, you know, Rodney the walkie-talkie. All these things were found out during the Commission of Inquiry itself.
Yeah, so that, I remember the Walter Rodney Foundation did a panel 2 years ago now, and it was really a historic panel. I think it was one of the first of the kind where it was you, your mother wasn't on the panel, I think, but she gave a lot of input during it. Dr. Benjamin, as well. But talking about the actual assassination and the Commission of Inquiry, and I remember learning these details about Smith and his involvement and just how deep the corruption really went. You know, like you said, first flight out, the assassination happened the next day. He was out of the country with the new passport, new birth certificate, new ID. Was disclaimed completely. It's hard for people today, you know, the average person is so trained to believe your government and whatever they say, and it's hard for people to even believe stories like that nowadays.
When you read the report, it doesn't sound like something that you would believe.
It's like fiction almost.
It is so detailed. It is so systematic when you talk about the planning, but the problem is no good deed, right? Mm. So even though they're planning these things, they're not foreseeing the mistakes. You can cover, but you can't cover everything. You know, this isn't the day of social media, but people are still seeing still seeing him. They know who he is. They recognize him. They're seeing him and his family on planes. They're seeing these planes moving around that the government is saying isn't moving around. So just the power of the people themselves, they're able to track some of these things that are happening as well. So even though they had a good plan, it wasn't not perfect. It wasn't perfect. And they made a lot of mistakes. And there was paper trails along the way that was uncovered during the Commission of Inquiry that was able to show what the government had actually done at the time.
I see. Is that the commission in front of you?
No, this is not a commission report.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. So this Commission of Inquiry, which took 2 years, it finishes it's ended, I guess I should say, in 2016, because the same party that they're investigating from 80, comes into power again right towards while they're finishing up and, you know, summarizing their findings. And the report, from what we have seen of it, is very damning to the entire government, to Smith, to many actors. And so what has the fight for justice looked like since then?
So since then, the fight for justice has been really a personal one. The report is still sitting there. The government has refused to acknowledge or accept the report, which means that the findings and recommendations have not even been considered. And the findings and recommendations are more around what's good for the country of Guyana in terms of their policies, police procedures, you know, having inquests that happen, you know, immediately after someone passes away,
not
talking
several
about
decades later.
Police records, because a lot of the files were lost. So when the commission would subpoena files or people, the police chiefs and the custodians would say, we don't know where the files are. They're missing. Lots of the files were missing. Some were claimed to be lost in fires or floods. And so talking about those processes, and, you know, for a civil society to exist, those things shouldn't, right, need to be corrected. But from the perspective of the actual finding, the finding was that Walter Rodney was assassinated on the behest of the state, on the behest of the prime minister, the police chief, the GDF, and all the people were implicated specifically in the commissioner's report. So it was an act of terror for political purposes,
right?
And you know what the act of terror is to make sure that other people are put on notice that this is what will happen to you.
Yep. To strike fear in a population.
So, I mean, the report itself, not perfect, because, of course, it was ended early. There could have been more information, but just on the wealth of information that was there, on everything they were able to find and track and trace, from the passports to the, you know, the police records and the police reports and the conflicting testimony from all these officers, they were able to say Walter Rodney was assassinated by the government. And that is a milestone in and of itself, because since his assassination in 1980, we didn't have that in writing from jurists who weighed the legal evidence. Okay? So it is a milestone. Are we where we are? Absolutely not. Because there has been no justice for Walter Rodney. There's no justice for my mother, for my siblings, for his siblings, okay? For the other fighters and activists at the time, and some of whom still live in Guyana, right? For Donald Rodney, there's no justice. And he's still fighting, you know, against his conviction. We're working on that as well. So the struggle really continues.
Right. It's almost as if when the, you know, the findings of the commission came, it's almost like the struggle started over, but it's like, you know, time to suit up. Like it's like a re-energization of this long struggle that you've already been undertaking.
Now we have something to, what do you say, hang our hat on. Now we have, what we knew is now in writing, and the evidence is there. But what we're fighting against is an institution and a government that's not interested in moving this forward, and they're not interested in any of the other dirty details that were not uncovered in this case. And they're not interested in justice for Walter Rodney. They're not interested in justice for anyone. And they're fine with continuing to divide the country on a racial platform. But it's reversed now, right? Because it was an Indo-Guyanese government. Now it's an Afro-Guyanese government. So they're fine with that. If they can continue to keep everybody separate, and they can continue to get voted in, that's what they're concerned about, right? They're not concerned about justice for Walter Rodney.
Right.
So our fight is going to be to pressure the Guyana government to accept this report, and that has to come from external sources. There are a few people who are fighting locally, but I would say that the strength of justice is going to have to be on an international platform, that we're going to have to find a way through any kind of international justice system, or through just the work of advocates and activists and scholars and academics worldwide, to push to have Rodney's death, have justice for Rodney, because it's not going to come out of the Guyana government. They're not going to roll over and say, oh, hey, I like this report and I'm sorry.
Right.
And funnily enough, that was what would have happened even before the Commission of Inquiry, because they knew what they knew even before this happened.
Right.
They knew it. And they knew what the potential evidence would be that would come out. But they refused. So in doing so, it gave us this amazing historical document from people who were involved in the struggle from both sides.
Right.
Some of the people were people committing terror in Guyana at the time who gave evidence.
Wow.
So we have lots of evidence, lots of testimony. So the push needs to be on an international platform for people to rally around this cause so that we can get justice.
Yeah, definitely. And I like what you mentioned about it needing to be an international, right? Like this needs to be something that an international community rallies around, because Rodney spent his life kind of as an internationalist, anti-imperialist, internationalist, you know, all these things, but he was just a traveler, and he inspired so many communities around the world. So it's almost as if now these communities need to give back right to the Rodney family by caring mm-hmm. and by showing up. I know that, so for not to get off topic real quick, but I do just want to uplift Donald Rodney. He's been seeking asylum, or living in Trinidad.
So, and it's not off topic. I mean, Donald is central to this quest for justice, mm-hmm. right? Because one, he's our family. Two, he was with my father when they were going through the process of getting the walkie-talkies. He was one of the main living eyewitnesses to the assassination. Okay? So his fight is central, right? He's been convicted. So he has to now challenge that. He temporarily sought asylum back in the 80s, and then he moved to Trinidad. He's an attorney now, trained attorney, because he lost his livelihood in Guyana at the time. Now he's more recently moved back to Guyana, and he is fighting his struggle from there.
Wow.
So he is absolutely central, because if we go back to even the inquest, which was found that Walter Rodney died in, you know, by misadventure and through unnatural circumstances. If that is reversed based on his testimony and not his false testimony, then we can start to unravel some of this stuff.
I see.
You know, so his fight to against his own conviction, it's critical because there's a lot of false evidence that was placed into the judicial record in Guyana. So Donald was in the hospital following the assassination, and he gave a statement at the hospital, but there's a false statement that was entered into the judicial record in Guyana, and that is one of the core things that's being challenged. Okay, that there was an admission by him in this so-called court hearing, and all that is false. And funnily enough, within the last 3 or 4 weeks, just due to Donald's work on the ground, going through the archives, reading the papers, he's found some evidence to corroborate his story. That's not the story I gave.
That's incredible.
Okay, so the work is ongoing, right? Mm-hmm. We still need witnesses to come forward who haven't. So the work is definitely ongoing. There are people that know things that have not been revealed in this commission of inquiry.
Definitely.
You know, where the bomb making materials actually came from. We know they were flown in from the U.S. and mm-hmm. we have certain things, but there's a lot more that we still need to know. But our fight is justice for Donald, to get him from under this conviction, but in doing so we can unravel the inquest, we can unravel these court proceedings, and we can unravel some more of the stuff underneath the report itself.
I see.
Right. And justice for the people of Guyana. There are people in Guyana who still live under the weight mm-hmm. of an authoritarian regime, right? So this work helps the people of Guyana, but the lessons learned from here help everyone.
Right, exactly. And I know that whenever I'm on social media, a lot of people who tweet at the Walter Rodney Foundation's account are people in Guyana who just want to remind people, or just, you know, reach out to the foundation and say, you know, we want justice, or I just taught in my class about Walter Rodney, or, you know, it's just like this spirit and this legacy are still there, and they're probably always going to be there. And as long as they're there, and now with Donald there on the ground doing this incredible work, it's almost as if in the past few years, it's like it started to turn faster now with this commission of inquiry. And if we could have it published kind of in our own independent way, or your own independent way, I should say, in some kind of book or maybe a printout pamphlet or something to distribute it, you know, just mapping out different ways to like spread this information as much as possible.
Yeah, and that's definitely something that we're working on, is trying to find a way to make the report, because I think when things are visual, when things are, people can hear and interact with information, it allows people to receive it differently, but also process it differently, and now say, okay, how can I make a difference?
Definitely.
And I think the strength of this community that we are speaking to is that people have so many diverse skills, right? So somebody may read that report and say, oh, I see something here I can help with, or, oh, I'm legal, I see this, or someone may be a technical expert. There's so many different skill sets that people just are reading and can discern information. Mm-hmm. And then we need those people, those teams of people around the world. Definitely. Who can say, hey, we can help. This is how we can help. Mm-hmm. Drive this process forward.
Or people who can even read it and just be inspired by it.
Be inspired,
you know,
by
not that reading the details of someone's assassination mm-hmm. should inspire you in mm-hmm. a sense, but it definitely can compel you and compel you to want to act.
And, and also to be a good journalist, right? Because for a lot of us, you don't have to be formally trained to be a journalist, to be investigating things, right?
Certainly.
And I think this is something that needs continued investigation and vigilance, particularly because some of the people who committed this act are still in power in Guyana and still in the hierarchy of the government, right?
Mm.
So extrajudicial killing and judicial conduct and killing is not something that we're unfamiliar with.
Certainly.
And of course, it's alleged those things continue. So when we don't deal with our history, these things are passing up through these skills are passing up through these generations of people, and they're still going untouched, right? So we as activists and journalists and just people who are reading this information or accepting this information need to continue to challenge it. It shouldn't have happened then, and it shouldn't be happening now, and the cover-up shouldn't be continuing.
Mm.
Particularly because with the commission, people were able to come forward to testify without the risk of being criminally charged, okay?
I see.
It wasn't a truth and reconciliation by any means, but it was a way for people who had information to come forward and to give their testimony. But people were still terrified to do so.
This was their first time that they could do that without fearing being put in jail or being fired or having the police mess with them, any kind of
retaliation. Well, people were terrified because don't forget, the time that when it started, there was a different government in power, but there were still all these undercurrents. I mean, Ghana is still tied in these parties. These are PPP and PNC mm-hmm. and opposing parties. That rivalry and that tension with the races and the parties is very much alive, and it's really in many ways worse than it was before. So even during the time of the inquiry, people were terrified of coming forward. Some people were threatened
mm-hmm.
In open court, before they gave their testimony. So this it was very, very intense. I just, the justice in this is, we as advocates, we as the family, we as people who believe in Walter Rodney's legacy, if we can come together and say, this is not good enough,
mm-hmm.
right? Guyana government, this is not good enough. What buttons can we push? Which people can we touch? What avenues can we move forward in that's going to put us on that path, that continued path toward justice?
Certainly. And So I want to ask you to tell the people different ways they can be involved in helping or different things they can share on Twitter or on Facebook. I'm so glad I got to do an entire episode mm-hmm. on this topic, because Walter Rodney is someone who has inspired everyone from Angela Davis, Kathleen Cleaver, to Kwame Nkrumah, Lumumba. Well, maybe not Lumumba, but yeah, mm-hmm. I'm just naming off names.
Yeah.
But the first, you know, just several notable people mm-hmm. around the world. The first time I met with some incarcerated organizers in mm-hmm. South Carolina a few years ago, I was just saying, do you want some books? What can I do? What can I give to you? And I said, what are you already reading? Right? I was like, what are you already reading so I know what you want? Because they just asked for me to supply books. And they were all like, oh, we have How Europe Underdeveloped Africa. And they were saying that they had formed their own little small mm-hmm. like reading group mm-hmm. around the book. So I think it just speaks to the power
mm-hmm.
of his legacy and his writing. So the fight for justice needs to be equally powerful and equally compelling. So what are some ways people listening can help out?
Well, I would say if people want to be direct volunteers, they can go to the Walter Rodney website, which is walterrodneyfoundation.org, and they can just sign up to be a volunteer. And because people have so many different skill sets, it's kind of like, okay, tell me what you can do, and then we'll talk about how your work would help the foundation. So that's one way. Another way they can help is to donate to the Walter Rodney Foundation, because we're continuing this fight for justice, and we need to be able to assemble as many people as we can in this fight and to gather evidence and really to take this to international judicial stage. So that would be also helpful. Talking about it, right? Getting a copy of the report, reading it, talking about it. You know, we're trying to build a better online platform and forum so that we can actively engage in discussions. This is not the first assassination. It's not going to be the last. So what are our lessons? What are we learning from this? Our young people, our millennials are targeted now, and it is different. Before, you know, Walter Rodney is just one person and they can follow your car and they can search your house. Now it's facial recognition. Right?
Right.
They don't need to do all of that, right? You can be tagged in anything and anywhere in the world now. So the ability of the state to act against us is so much more intense. So what do we need to do to make sure that we continue to be activists, but continue to be scholar activists with that deep level of fear? Especially now, people tell me, you know what, I am so fearful in my advocacy. And it's understandable, right? People are trolled online, you know, just for taking a stance on something. So I would say to find a community where we can talk openly about issues with each other without, you know, being judged or without being fearful is important on any issue. And with respect to the inquiry, absolutely. If we can have a forum where we're discussing ideas about how we can advance this on several levels, that would be really, really amazing. So people engaging with us and allowing us to engage with them is very important.
Definitely. And I want to stress the important work that the Walter Rodney Foundation does here in the city of Atlanta, and as well as online. The online presence is definitely building and growing, but it is an organization ran by the Rodney family itself and many other volunteers and incredible activists and scholars that does essentially free political education and holds grounding sessions regularly. Do you want to tell the people in a sentence or two what a grounding is while we have you here?
So a groundings is, and it wasn't developed by Walter Rodney. This is something that was more organic.
Mm-hmm. He sort of just named
he,
it.
And so even in Jamaica, groundings is where, you know, people get together and they talk about their issues. And it's a learning, it's a back and forth. So Rodney didn't feel as if I'm teaching about African history, but I am receiving more, just as much information as I'm giving, right? So we ground together, we sit, actually it might be on my shirt, we sit, we talk, we listen, we contribute, we reason, and we gain from each other. That's really what groundings is about. And from Rodney's perspective, it was about Black people grounding together so that we could understand our history. Because one of the things that we as a people don't do is understand ourselves. And when we don't understand ourselves, we're really not functional because we're seeing ourselves through somebody else's lens, right? Mm-hmm. So for most people, we're seeing ourselves through a Western or Eurocentric lens. And what he wanted was for us to be able to sit and talk, understand our history, understand who we are as a people. When we can do that, then color race goes away. But until that point, we're not there. So grounding is a way for us all to get together and sit and talk and understand each other. And so that's critical for grounding. So we try to replicate that in our symposium by doing an annual groundings within our symposium. Mm-hmm. And that grounding session could be several sessions within the symposium itself, but it's essentially for us to really just sit and talk. You know, let everybody express their views, and then we discuss things in an open way and we learn from each other. And so that's essentially what the groundings is.
Thank you. It's very very similar to Paulo Freire's cultural circles.
Yes.
You know, the best way of learning.
And groundings could have happened anywhere, right? So for him, it happened, whether we call it a bottom house, a street corner, a rally. Groundings could happen anywhere. They're organic. Mm-hmm. And everybody participates.
Definitely. The first time I ever heard about Walter Rodney, I was in Jamaica as a kid, and it was just this Rasta man who, you know, him and my dad were talking, and they were just talking. My dad's not the most political person, but he has these random radical views. Mm-hmm. And they started talking about Walter Rodney. Mm-hmm. And I guess the man was a professor at UWI, and that's why he was mentioning him. So then when I moved to Atlanta and I found the Walter Rodney Foundation, it all clicked. Mm-hmm. And here we are today talking about how to seek justice for him and the family. Mm-hmm. Well, are there anything else you would like to say to the people or anything?
No, I think we covered everything in terms of where we are. This is, you know, one of the moments that we need to seize, right? Because it's already been 2016 is when this report was issued. We are now in 2018, mm-hmm. right? The passage of time continues regardless of what we're doing. So I think I would love the audience to be able to connect with us in a way that allows us to drive this process forward with their help and with their engagement. And then just to stay connected with the Walter Rodney Foundation and with you, with the Grounding Show, because I think this is a phenomenal platform to be able to reach out to let people know what we're doing and also to listen to what people are interested in hearing. And then, of course, the annual symposium is coming up, so we would love people to come out to the symposium and also to engage with us on online platforms for those people that can't be there.
Can you give the date and location of the symposium?
Absolutely. So the 15th annual Walter Rodney Symposium will be held this March 23rd and 24th, which is a Friday and Saturday, at the Atlanta University Center Robert Woodruff Library. And it's a two-day symposium. And this year our theme is 1968. So we're looking at the 50 years since 1968 and what we've accomplished and not. We're doing Black Studies at 50. We'll be having a panel on, obviously, what happened in 68 globally. We're looking at what happened in 68 in Jamaica, mm-hmm. Which, you know, preceded the Rodney Riots and the book The Groundings with my brothers. And we're looking at the intersection of sports, race, and politics.
Oh, wow.
Because we feel that this is one of the issues that younger people are very engaged in, both from a scholar and a scholar activist perspective, and looking at how we can use our power in sports, but use that as a lesson for other, right? Because sports is just one area. So we're looking at how that intersection, so that's going to be amazing. And we're going to have some really good speakers. And for the first time, we're also going to be doing a co-host panel. So we're going to have a panel at the Charles Wright Museum of African History in Detroit.
Yes.
So that panel will be live streamed here in Atlanta. So that's a first for us doing
that.
That's exciting. We're going to have Bobby Hill on that panel and Dr. Rodney on that panel. So it's going to be really interesting this year. We're going to have a short film on Walter Rodney that's being done by Dr. Smith out of the University of the West Indies Mona campus, of Walter Rodney's years at UE as an undergraduate.
Mm-hmm.
So that's going to be really phenomenal. And interestingly enough, we just received about a year, less than a year ago, Walter Rodney's papers, his notes, mm-hmm. his academic notes when he was at the University of the West Indies. So those are now in the archives. So for people that don't know, that's another huge thing. For people that don't know, Walter Rodney's papers are housed at the within the archives at the Woodruff Library. And the collection is growing, and we're asking people that know Walter Rodney from whether it's a student, whether you know him in passing, whether he was a friend of yours, an associate, whether he impacted your life, to tell us about it so that we can include it in the archives to build this legacy project. So we're doing oral history interviews, we're accepting, you know, letters and images and everything from around the world. So we're asking people to be a part of that project. So one of the things that people can do is tell us, like, you know, how has Walter Rodney impacted your life, or how did you impact his? Because for mm-hmm. some people, they knew him, and they impacted him in
right.
some way. So kind of knowing from both perspectives. So we're building that project as well.
Well, that sounds exciting. I can't wait. You know, I'll be there front and center, live tweeting the whole thing. And I'll record some audio while I'm there, too, to share with the Groundings listeners. Or my awesome sound guy, Christopher, will probably be there as well with the microphone ready to record. Well, I want to thank you, Asha, for coming on the podcast, the Groundings podcast, and talking with me. It was a wonderful conversation. It's always wonderful to see and speak with you.
And I want to thank you, too. I think I'm not sure what year we met, Devin, but you've been amazing and inspirational in all the work that you do here in Atlanta, now globally, because, you know, I'm new to social media, but I see Devin everywhere, right?
So. Before we end, I gotta tell, the other day when I was on the phone with Asha, it was 2 days after my birthday, it was like a week after my birthday, and she says, I was so excited to see you had a birthday, and I was very confused. And then you said, oh, I mean, because I'm new to Facebook. And I just thought that was so funny. All right, well, I think that's that for that. Thank you again.
Thank you, too. And thanks to your audience for tuning in as well.
Definitely.